Our first case today is case number 72005, Carr versus State. Now this, I wanted to make an announcement also about Justice Perigary. He'll listen to the tape on this. He's under the weather right now. He's got a medical problem with an arm and stuff. And he missed yesterday and today. But he'll listen to the oral arguments from both days, and then we'll conference on with him on this. So you won't miss out. You'll get the votes from all three of us on these cases. And we have Mr. Mueller, Mr. Nelson, both attorneys that I've known for a long time. And at your table is?
This is Trustee Bernstein, my office.
How do you do? Welcome to the Supreme Court.
For the record,
Mr. Carr. Nice to see you, sir. All right, we're ready to go, Mr. Mueller.
Yes, sir. Madam Clerk, I can reserve the energy for rebuttal. Thank you, sir.
With the pleasure of the court, let's proceed. William McCool was a classmate of mine at the Naval Academy. His space shuttle burned up over the sky and killed him. His space shuttle burned up because of a small hole in the space shuttle wing. And I'll bring that up because it comes to mind. I drove past William McCool Science Center today and it brought him to mind. Small problems early in cases frequently will have catastrophic results. And in this case, we are here to complain about what was a improper joinder in justice court of a misdemeanor with a felony charge at a preliminary hearing. This is improper procedure, and in my 25 years of practicing law, I've never done it, nor allowed it, nor seen it. However, it was done here by a justice of the peace. This is a small hole in the wing of the shuttle that caused a catastrophic miscarriage of justice down the line, and if I could elaborate. Mr. Carr and his mother, who's since passed, were spending the evening. I've known Mr. Carr off and on now since, I don't even remember, 1973. We went to sixth grade together. Mr. Carr and his mother were driving home from the Orleans, and they had the misfortune of passing an establishment called Jack Potter's Bar. Whatever happened there was never eventually clear. There was a report of a man down in the parking lot. Later it was a drunken disorderly. We don't know. Never did come out at trial. Mr. Carr's 13-passenger van drove past that location. A few moments later, about 0.8 mile later, Mr. Carr's van is pitted by a very young police officer. He's pulled from the car at gunpoint, thrown to the ground, and is subsequently held. He and his mother are held, and then he is subsequently charged with a series of felonies and a misdemeanor DUI. Not surprisingly, Mr. Carr, who has zero prior criminal record, zero involvement in law enforcement, was inclined to cooperate in any way, shape, or form, and immediately after being pulled from the pavement, he decided to invoke his right to remain silent and sat silently at a curb. He was subsequently arrested by the explanation officer, Artoski, at the scene. Since he refused to cooperate, he couldn't prove he wasn't intoxicated. Therefore, we arrested him. That's by way of background. We come to the preliminary hearing. A relatively inexperienced lawyer had the matter set, and the matter was set for both hearing and trial on the misdemeanor. I've advocated for DUIs for juries, but that's a different discussion. Having said that, the matter was set simultaneously. Counsel for Mr. Carr objected. He didn't use the exact words, the talismanic phrase, "I object," but said, "Aren't we going to bifurcate these?" or words to that effect. Mr. Nelson felt sufficiently on notice that he replied in it. And the Justice of the Peace joined a trial which had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt and a misdemeanor or a bindover on the felony at the same proceedings. This is flawed, and this error then creates a series of downstream problems. Number one, and the court's done a number of DUI trials, the blood draw was outside of 2 hours. Mr. Carr didn't do any field sobriety tests after being thrown to the ground and held at gunpoint. He didn't want to cooperate with officers. So the only remaining theory of liability, any evidence that Mr. Carr had been intoxicated, was the fact that he had bad driving. Now, the officers testified that there had been this high speed or chase, and that Mr. Carr's van had been engaged in fantastical maneuvers, including a 360-degree turn without driving over the sidewalk, a fact that the officers subsequent and expert witnesses said was actually impossible to do. The jury subsequently found at trial that the maneuvers didn't happen and Mr. Carr was cleared of those wrongdoing. However, here has catastrophic mistakes and problems. Mr. Carr has to testify at trial to establish that the high-speed chase didn't happen and that he and his mother were actually just driving home when he got pitted. Or, pitted is a, I don't remember the exact phrase, but it's basically when you get, what they do in stock car racing, you put the fender behind another car and you throw it sideways off your center of gravity so that it spins the car out. Mr. Carr has to testify, then the Justice of the Peace, unaware that the officers had written reports, unaware that the officers had colluded on their reports, unaware that the officers' reports contradicted their testimony, then convicted Mr. Carr. There's something called a blue team report. In 25 years of dealing with and around Metropolitan Police Department, I know these reports to exist as a matter of course. If an officer is involved in use of force or an automobile accident or any unusual proceedings before they're allowed to go home from that shift, while their memory is fresh, they are required to independently write a report. When counsel for Mr. Carr at the Justice Court asked about these reports, he said, "We didn't prepare any," which is actually a perjurious statement that was actually later proved to be not only false, but knowingly false.
The officer denied preparing a blue sheet?
Both Kleehammer and McKnight were the two officers that testified at trial, testified that neither had prepared a report.
And when you say at trial, you're referring to the misdemeanor trial?
The misdemeanor trial, and then subsequently at the DUI, or the felony trial, which I handled, that also came out and as well. So they denied, so the Justice of the Peace, relatively inexperienced Justice of the Peace, had only Mr. Carr's testimony, convicted him of the bad driving, and that establishes the misdemeanor DUI, which makes the traffic stop a felony under subsection 5 of the failure to stop statute. So now we go up to trial, and I'm counsel of record, and I say politely at first and then emphatically later, where's the blue team reports? We don't have any. Where's the blue team reports? We don't have any. Where's the blue team reports? I've checked. I'm telling you in writing, there are no reports. Well, if I told you there was no paperwork on my desk, you wouldn't believe it because you've been around a long time. I've been around a long time, and I didn't believe it either. After passage of time, I eventually called civil counsel for the department and circumvented the entire chain of command through the criminal structure, and within 45 minutes had a promise to have the blue team reports delivered to me. Once I had the blue team reports, I was able to ascertain that what had been testified to in Justice Court was perjurious. The reports had been prepared. Not only had the reports been prepared, they were the reports that were a result of collusion. There are comments my Ms. Bernstein cited and pulled exact comments out of the report. Remember to put in the report what I told you to. Make sure you add the information I told you to. That's or words to that effect. I mean, that's a paraphrase. Those reports are in the report. So now I see what is clearly I knew was incorrect, and we moved to remand the case for a new trial in Justice Court. We were said, well, it's been outside of 2 years. Well, I've been asking for it for 2 years, so now we've got a DUI conviction that we have to answer for, and now we've got to go on failure to stop. Now Mr. Carr's testimony is now used against him. We go to trial, and we're cleared on everything, cleared all the charges, jury doesn't find the police chase, doesn't find all the officers credible. But however, they now use the testimony from Justice Court. Well, yeah, I saw them and I was pulling off the Amberwood to get out of their way. Mr. Nelson uses that and they convict him of failure to stop. And because it was a misdemeanor that was had without the Brady material, he's convicted. And now it gets upgraded to a felony. So Mr. Carr, 56 years old, no prior criminal record, driving his mother home, is now a convicted felon. Now, the most fundamental problems with our legal system are failure to disclose information. This is Brady material. It could not have been more inflammatory. It could not have been more exonerating. We got a DUI conviction of it because it wasn't provided in a timely fashion. Because we get a DUI conviction, we now have to face felony charges. We walk him on everything. None of the evidence is credible except for Mr. Carr's statement, which is, yeah, I didn't stop because I was pulling off the side of the street, so the jury convicts him of the failure to use. It's wildly improper, and just like Mr. McCool's space shuttle, the small mistake down below cascades right down the system, and now we're here complaining of the error caused. Now, Brady material. The state is not a private entity. They have no fiscal or financial interest. They have a duty to provide information. My complaint with and desire to get the Brady material, the Blue Team reports, could not have been more emphatic, more insistent, or more consistent. In fact, I was assured in writing, and on Mr. Nelson, who enjoys a good reputation with me, that they didn't exist. It took me maybe two phone calls and 45 minutes to confirm that they did, in fact, exist, and civil counsel eventually provided it to me in court. So now we have exculpatory evidence that was not provided that would have changed the outcome below, that would have kept the matter out of district court entirely. And now we're going to trial in district court because of it. Now, that's failure to improperly join is plain error, and this conviction should be reversed. Failure to disclose in a timely manner the exculpatory evidence is clearly plain error, and this case should be reversed. Third, individually, say if you reject either both of the legal assertions, then we come to the factual assertions. There is no evidence that he was willful in his failure to stop. Since the jury found him not guilty and of this the maneuvers earlier in the ceremony, all we have is literally Mr. Carr coming past the stop line, going through Rainbow, going up the residential street, and turning right. There wasn't even sufficient time for him to be willful in his failure to stop. The jury was not, could not have gotten this conviction. There's no mechanism to get there. In fact, specifically, all the officer said, you follow people, sometimes they don't check in your rearview mirror. Oh, yes, sir, it happens. They argue what happened. Bob Holland said it happened all the time to him when he was a motorcycle officer. The other officer said it happens occasionally. Sometimes don't stop. But there has to be a willful. Willful is the essential element. There is no evidence of willfulness anywhere in the transcript that sufficient to support the conviction.
Sir, did they testify that they were code 3 when they were pulling him over?
No. In fact, that was actually some of the most important problems. And I want you to understand, I've been around young men. I've trained them in the service. I've been to all military school. I've been in the service. Been the ship. Here is the abbreviated list of procedures that would have been violated. Number one, they failed to clear the radio channels. Number two, they failed to call out a code red. They failed to ask for supervisory authority to do the pit maneuver. Number four, they pursuant to negotiations or pursuant to procedure, they failed to consider the alternatives. Five, they failed to inform dispatch of a pursuit. I want you to understand that. We're in pursuit. We don't tell anybody. Now, human beings are adrenaline creatures. The minute that rush of adrenaline comes up, everyone's voice gets a little higher. Everyone starts moving a little quicker. No evidence of that. This is a pursuit. And they called out, failed to call out the location, tell anybody where there was. And the most informative piece of information, two pieces of information that came out. The Kleehammer, the sergeant, the 19-year man, testifies that McKnight, the young man, who he subsequently later has been terminated from Metro, actually went past his sergeant's car, not once, but apparently twice, to produce the pit maneuver. So the experienced officer is following the car, the young man pulls out around and then executes the pit maneuver. And that, Mr. Nelson, I'm only going to see a Freudian slip, says, yeah, the man was terminated. Our request for his employment records and the conditions of his termination were not met. We did not do to this day. I don't know why he was terminated. Justices, I'd ask you to reverse the conviction. I believe his case is meritorious, and I believe an injustice has occurred here.
Thank you, Mr. Miller. Mr. Nelson, on behalf of the state of Nevada.
Justices, let me start by reading day two of the trial. Showing you the last page of your report, quote, there is no doubt the car was failing to pull over for an emergency vehicle that had its emergency equipment activated. Answer, all right. So you have no doubts that Mr. Carr failed to stop for a vehicle, police vehicle. Yes, sir. That wasn't testified to by a state witness. That was testified to by defense expert Robert Holland. Same day. All right, would you agree in this case that based on everything you reviewed, the defendant was driving while intoxicated? Answer, yes. That was testified to by defense expert William Morrison. So what's the defendant to do when his own witnesses are saying he's guilty of these offenses? Well, he adopts the advice of Cicero and Carl Sandburg. The law and the facts are against you, attack the other side. And he makes two attacks. First of all, he claims that the preliminary hearing and the misdemeanor trial should not have been held at the same time. Well, there's four reasons why he's wrong. First of all, and most importantly, he never appealed the DUI conviction. That was a misdemeanor conviction. He never appealed it to the district court, or I should say never. He filed an appeal a year later. But he never sought review, and this court, as it is repeatedly held, doesn't have jurisdiction to review a misdemeanor conviction. So I don't know why he thinks he can bring all those things up today. Second, he never sought bifurcation of the case. Mr. Abitangelo, defense counsel, after being asked by the court, do you want the witnesses excluded, said yes, and then he went on to say, the second thing is, with the misdemeanor, either bifurcate it or however you want to handle it, whatever the court's policy. The state then suggested that the two matters be kept together in one hearing. The court said, okay, handle both of them. Abitangelo's response, all right. Well, all right and however you want to handle it are not synonymous with we object. They never objected until long after the preliminary hearing and the misdemeanor trial. Third, they never set forth a basis to sever. This court held in Honeycutt versus State that the defense bears the burden of showing why charges should be severed. Well, they never made any claim that they needed to be severed. Now, long after the hearing, they're claiming, oh, well, we wanted to testify as to the DUI, but not as to the preliminary hearing, but they never claimed that before or during the preliminary hearing or the DUI. Finally, even if the case had been severed, it wouldn't have made any difference. Due to the nature of one of the charges against the defendant, namely that he was evading a police officer after having been convicted of a DUI, the DUI trial had to go first. So if he had testified at the DUI trial, what he said would have still been used against him. The evading charge could not have been bound up until he was convicted of a DUI. So there was simply no basis in this case to sever. The defense never sought it, and they never appealed the conviction. Discovery. Well, they claim that the state didn't provide them discovery, and I'm going to split that into two parts. Discovery before the preliminary hearing misdemeanor and afterwards. Afterwards, there is no issue. Mr. Mueller admitted on January 7th, 2015, that he had the blue team reports. The trial occurred in February, 1 year later. Despite having all those reports, supposedly exculpatory and all these supposed problems with their reports, the jury nonetheless convicted the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt of two counts of evading a police officer. Obviously, the reports weren't as exculpatory as the defense thought, and if they're not exculpatory in terms of beyond a reasonable doubt, then how can they be for a preliminary hearing when the standard is slight or marginal evidence? When we talk about preliminary hearing and discovery before the misdemeanor trial, there is a statute, NRS 171, 1965, that says the defense is entitled to get what's in the possession of the prosecuting attorney before a preliminary hearing. They got that. They got the police reports. They got the nurse's affidavit. They got the chemical test result. They didn't ask for anything else.
But Mr. Nelson, wouldn't, because you're having a trial at the same time as a preliminary hearing, aren't we operating under the other standard?
Well, I'm going to address that in just a moment, Your Honor. My point is there's no violation of the preliminary hearing standard because they never asked for anything. They didn't ask for the blue team reports before the misdemeanor trial or before the preliminary hearing. And the statute cannot be interpreted to make the state guess at what they want and then provide it to them. With regard to before trial, there is a different standard. It does say in the possession of the state. So the blue team reports or the use of force reports would potentially be available to them. But they didn't comply with the first sentence of the statute, the most important six words in that statute. At the request of the defendant, I would invite the court to ask Mr. Mueller, where in the record did they request these reports prior to the misdemeanor hearing? They never did. Now, there is one potential exception to that rule, and that was set forth by the court in Jimenez versus State. Quote, in cases where the defense makes no request or a general request for evidence, if the omitted evidence creates a reasonable doubt which did not otherwise exist, constitutional error has been committed. Well, this case is unique because we know the evidence did not create a reasonable doubt. How do we know that? Because the finders of fact told us so. The jury told us in the felony trial, because a year after he had the evidence and used the trial and everything else, they nonetheless convicted the defendant. So obviously, the evidence did not create a reasonable doubt. With regard to the justice of the peace, one of the things they did was move to vacate the trial. The justice of the peace denied that request, and one of the things she found was, even if you had presented this evidence, it was not material to the DUI charge. Why? Because the evidence addressed the chase, the evading ended, then the DUI investigation began. So that finder of fact also told us, even if I had had this, I would have still convicted the defendant beyond a reasonable doubt.
Those charges are they're intertwined. I mean, part of the reason for the DUI stop was this alleged driving pattern. And you can't really separate out these two cases.
Well, I believe you can, because the evading began when the defendant failed to stop for the police. Eventually, the police used a precision immobilization technique and stopped the defendant. Then an officer came over and did the DUI investigation. So yes, the driving is perhaps intertwined, but the DUI is clearly separable from the evading, because the DUI didn't begin until the evading ended.
Well, when you're evading, you're presumably DUI. I mean, they're using the way that you're driving as circumstantial evidence of drunkenness, I would imagine, since you don't have a test, you don't have FSTs, it's going to be the driving pattern, red watery eyes, whatever other objective symptomology they added.
Well, Justice, the evading statute actually has two separate violations. One is you evade when you're endangering or likely to endanger others. You don't have to be drunk to do that. The second one is if you're convicted of a misdemeanor or DUI arising out of the same evading, then you're guilty of that section. So you don't need to be drunk in order to evade.
Okay, would the judge have considered the fact of the way the person was driving as evidence in the DUI?
Probably.
Okay.
But in any event, the judge said, this doesn't change my mind. I would still have found the defendant guilty of the DUI. By the way, the defendant says there were no field sobriety tests. He refused to take them. Now, he argues he's entitled to do that. Well, actually, no, he isn't. The United States Supreme Court held in Pennsylvania versus Munez that the Fifth Amendment does not apply to most aspects of a field sobriety test because they're non-testimonial. Several states have interpreted that to mean that if you refuse to take field sobriety tests, that refusal can be used against you in the same way that if you refuse to be fingerprinted, refuse to be in a lineup, refuse to provide an invoice exemplar, all those are evidence of guilt. So yes, there were no field sobriety tests, but only because he refused to take them. There was a chemical test where he was a 0.16, and the testimony by the chemist was he could not have been below a 0.08 while he was driving. But in any event, again, the defense doesn't get to bring these up because they never appealed the DUI conviction. Finally, his last two arguments, he argued there was no proof of intent. Well, quite simply, yes, there was. The officers testified that at one point one of them went around his car to the front of it. He drove around them. His own witness, as I mentioned at the beginning, said he was guilty of evading a police officer. And the defendant, although he didn't use the words evading, also acknowledged that he evaded the police. Because he said, I knew at the Rainbow intersection the police were behind me. I drove through the intersection, continued down the road, and by the way, behind me with lights and sirens, down the road, made a turn, and then I got pitted. So even he, while he didn't use the word evade, acknowledged that he did evade. Viewing all that evidence in the light most favorable to the state, which is the standard, clearly there was evidence that he willfully sought to evade. Finally, his last argument is the cumulative evidence argument. Well, I think I've shown his first three arguments amount to nothing. Zero plus zero plus zero does not equal one. So there was no cumulative violation here. Justices, unless you have any other question, that's really all I have.
Yes, sir. I have one too. Go ahead.
How do we write this if we feel that there's been an error in joining a DUI with the evading? How do we write it? I mean, this is a learning experience. Those folks out there are going to be practicing law, and they want to know if they've got this type of situation, whether they can have a preliminary hearing and a misdemeanor trial at the same time. The issue is now, as some of my colleagues say, teed up, which means we have to answer that issue about whether there was error or not. And if then we have to determine whether it was harmless error that the JP allowed it. Which JP allowed this, by the way?
Judge Bauckham. She's the DUI judge. Well, I would answer you in two ways.
Because I've never seen it. I only practiced for 48 years and never saw it, as a judge and as a lawyer. And I've never had a misdemeanor trial at the same time as I had a felony preliminary hearing, especially because there's something about
saying to a defendant, you don't have to testify at the preliminary hearing, but Mr. Carr testified, I understand. He testified at the DUI trial.
He did.
Well, the, what I'll say to you, Mr. Nelson, you do a lot of DUIs. You're the king of this for the Clark County District Attorney's Office for years. Watch out what you wish for or you may get it.
Well,
if you do, all of a sudden you're going to have people asking for joinders, and if you're not ready on the DUI trial, that could really hurt some convictions as far as you're concerned. Just some thoughts. And well, Justice Stiglitz had something also.
Did you want to respond?
My response would be, number one, there was no error, but number two, if you do find error, because the defendant never objected, never sought severance, and never provided a reason for it, you should find in this case that the error was harmless. They can't sit quietly, then come up later after everything and say, oh, well, we wanted to testify as to one and not the other. Secondly, Honeycutt addressed the exact situation where the defendant said, well, I want to testify on one charge but not the others. This court held that's not a basis to sever.
Mr. Nelson, why would it take almost 4 years for your office to produce, and not even the criminal division, but the civil division, documents that that should be known or prepared in the ordinary course of these type of incidents involving either use of force or some sort of automobile interaction? Why would it take 4 years to, A, acknowledge the existence of those, and B, turn them over?
Well, Justice, it didn't take 4 years. Mm-hmm. That's a misstatement. He never requested the documents before the preliminary hearing or the misdemeanor trial. My timeline is he did a general discovery motion on January 29, 2014. We were set to go to trial on March 10th. On March 10th, the defendant literally, or defense counsel, literally marched into court and said, oh, by the way, here are my expert witness reports. The court found that he intentionally failed to provide those reports, sanctioned him, and ordered him to pay the witness fees of one of the out-of-state witnesses the state had flying in, which, by the way, he's never paid. Then he filed a motion that was put on calendar for discovery on November 13th, 2014, January 7th, 2015, roughly 2 months later, he acknowledged he had the reports. Now, it took a little bit of time because, frankly, I have to confess my ignorance. I had never heard of a blue team report. We don't get a lot of use of force things in DUI cases. Mm-hmm. But once we found out they existed, we got them to him within 2 months, not 4 years. He wasn't even on the case 4 years.
Well, I'm not concerned with his request, just about the fact that those existed at the time of the DUI trial.
Well, they were
their statements of your witnesses.
Yes.
That you're calling, that are in the possession.
Well, they were never sought prior to the DUI trial. The defense never asked for them then. And in any event, I have to, since I have a couple mm-hmm. minutes, let me address the claim that the officer perjured himself. The officer never said, I didn't do use of force reports or I didn't do any reports. He was asked by the defense, well, how come I have reports from lieutenants but not from you? And he said, quote, you generally don't do all the reports if you're involved. Well, saying you generally don't do all the reports and you, if you're involved, is a far cry from saying I didn't do any use of force reports. And then later he explained, the question, the way it was phrased, I believe they were asking if I prepared the reports out there that day. All right, internal reports later, no, I didn't consider those as the reports he was talking about. But he brought his motion, the important point is, in November, he got it in January. And it did take a little bit of time also because these are internal police documents, which may or may not be privileged. Metro eventually decided, well, we'll just go ahead and give them to him, but that shouldn't waive any future claim that they might be privileged. A use of force report is what the police department uses to investigate its own officers. It's similar to an officer's personnel file. You don't get those simply by asking them. Justices, if you have no more questions, thank you for your consideration.
Mr. Mueller?
Thank you, Justice. I'll be brief.
My colleague, in his enthusiasm for his case, overlooks the element of the crime, which is willful. If you are pondering a case as you drive home tonight and a police officer falls in behind you and wants to give you a speeding ticket and you're thinking about the case, drive 3 or 4 blocks, that's not a felony. There's an element of willfulness. That might be a misdemeanor, failure to attend to your driving, but that's not a felony. That's a big difference here. The element of this case is willfulness, which there is no evidence of willfulness. My colleague wants to kind of shuffle the shells around on this. There's an element of willfulness for the felony charge. Number two, Justice, I believe you're correct. I believe this is the case is now fairly and firmly presented. I believe an opinion from this court directing the lower courts not to join misdemeanor trials and felony preliminary hearings as a matter of course
is warranted in this circumstance. But we both have done, been doing this quite a few years now, particularly since the constitutional rights that are given up for the misdemeanor conviction would require a Feretta canvas of the open district court. There needs to be a procedure in place to protect people in justice court. And especially in these circumstances where the legislature saw it fit to have an enhanceable status, there needs to be a plea canvas, and it is not harmless error. This is real error, and there's real harm to it. And I do not believe, or I believe you're correct, you presented the issue fairly and firmly, and this would be a great opportunity to address it.
Mr. Mueller, just briefly, to Mr. Nelson's arguments, what effect of no appeal of the DUI conviction, how should we consider that, and what effect of the kind of at best ambiguous, which I think you kind of conceded, ambiguous objection to the bifurcation? How do we deal with those facts?
Two things. Number one, is the issue was clearly raised. Mr. Wilson clearly felt the need to respond to it, so it was raised in the record. Number two is plain error doctrine. It's clearly error on its face, and the court can always address plain error. Additionally, it was 2 years, 11 months, and one day. The U court always has the ability to vacate a conviction. If you later found it, like Stettermeyer, the murder case, you later find out that evidence was not withheld or exculpatory, this court always has the authority to vacate convictions. Now, there was blue team reports out there in government files that directly contradicted testimony taken under oath that show that witnesses perjured themselves. That always gives this court leave to vacate a conviction under those circumstances. I did, in district court, ask that the case be remanded with the new evidence, and when I received in front of the Justice of the Peace, who made the mistake in the first place, she ruled, it's been 2 years, you don't have any remedy, despite the fact that the state conceded there's 2 years, 11 months before I actually got the blue team reports. Now, this is a very important issue. I believe the court is correct, and that this is an issue that could be addressed, and this could be making or adding to Nevada law to protect people in the future. Mr. Carr, you can see, is a law-abiding citizen with no criminal record except, I think, a traffic citation when he was a kid. Literally, that's it. He gets pitted, pulled out at gunpoint, and then gets blamed for not doing the field sobriety test and not talking to police. I submit a judge.
Thank you.
Justices.
Thanks to both Mr. Mueller and Mr. Nelson. I've known both of them for a long, long time, and they're excellent lawyers, and they did an excellent job on argument, both of them. Congratulations to both sides on this. This is a tough case for us. This matter will stand submitted. Thank you very much for your